Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
It is a rainy Thursday at 1 o'clock, and you are tuned into the Heritage Radio Network. You're listening to The Farm Report, and I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks. We're coming to you live from the back of Roberta's in lovely Bushwick, Brooklyn. And today we are on the line with Anthony Butler, Executive Director of St. John's Bread and Life. Anthony, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Erin.
So great to have you on. I know you're in transit, so thanks for taking the time out to come back to the station.
I'd rather be having lunch at Roberta's than in the airport.
Yeah, kind of a juxtaposition, huh? So I would love to just kind of start out with getting a brief overview. I know that Bread and Life has a lot of different programs and that you guys work basically to alleviate hunger and poverty in Brooklyn and Queens, but maybe you can just give us a sense of the scope of your services and then a little bit about kind of who's using you guys and how.
Sure. Bread and Life, we're located in Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn, and we're one of the largest emergency food providers in New York City. Last year, we did over 500,000 meals to hungry New Yorkers and served about 23,000 folks. We provide food, both hot food and a food pantry that folks can take home. We have a mobile soup kitchen that goes to six different communities in Brooklyn and Queens. We also have a significant social services to help people with issues of poverty. Folks can apply for their food stamps on site. They can apply for Medicaid on site. We have free immigration help. We have right now going on a tax program that's free for any families under $50,000 and any individuals under $18,000, free tax prep 4 days a week. We have legal services on site. We help folks navigate to procure various identification documents they might need and various other referrals for mental health, substance abuse, and housing issues.
You sound like the one-stop shopping for a lot of your clients. Yeah, yeah. So, well, you are on the Farm Report, so of course we kind of want to take a focus on food and that aspect of what you guys do. So I wanted to tuck into a little bit about procurement. And so I know you guys are offering food in kind of a multitude of ways, both by serving meals daily on site, and then you have the mobile units, and then you also do a food pantry. So can you talk a little bit about how food comes in, like what are the sources that food comes into Bread and Life from?
The sources of our food initially, the financial sources are private donations, kind of classic food donations and food drives, and government money that helps pay for food. So those are our sources of income. In terms of who we procure from, one of the things we're doing now, because we believe that the only, probably the best and most robust group who'd be able to respond to the issues of hunger is the food community. And particularly in Brooklyn, with it's a very strong community. And to that, we're dramatically increasing our procurement from purveyors of New York State products, both farmers and kind of value-added purveyors too.
So when you're looking, let's say I'm the chef at the main kitchen there, and I'm sitting down to schedule my meals for the next week or the next month.
Right.
Kind of, how are those decisions being shaped? I mean, do you guys have to follow certain regulations with regards to nutritional content, or is there access to particular food items that you like? You know, get a lot of certain types of things that you work in, or.
Exactly. I mean, we have nutritional guidelines we have to follow because, as the listeners may or may not be aware, Bed-Stuy has one of the highest rates of childhood obesity, diabetes, and hypertension, and has one of the least accesses to fresh produce. So we're definitely a nutritional component that involves our procurement. We also realistically have to procure stuff that's affordable. And adjust our menus to that. We also feel a very strong obligation because we are publicly supported to place those resources that we receive, those monies we receive, back into the community. And so we're looking at kind of long-term procurement processes with New York State farmers and New York State value-added folks. So just to give you an example, our Christmas program, which served over 2,000 families, provided a Christmas meal and toys for 2,000 families. We spent approximately $65,000 all on New York State products.
And what do you think are some, I mean, why is that not just kind of the norm? Like, what are some of the barriers to making those types of purchases?
Barriers would probably be several. I mean, one is just kind of the historicity of how you've done things all the time. And traditionally, food pantries they had to receive whatever people gave them. And traditionally, it was, you know, someone went to the Key Food or the local supermarket and bought some pasta and tuna and gave it, and then it was given out again, which did not have the nutritional impact, nor did it really address the poverty. That coupled with, like a lot of folks know, it's much easier to order from a large food purveyor, a Sysco or a Driscoll or one of those, not to disparage that, but it's much easier just to go online, place your order in, and it comes. Coupled with that, some of our government contracts historically had were basically lines of credit that encouraged us or forced us. We had to work through those large food distribution agencies or distribution companies. But now, and I think part of the thing is, too, there's a much more, as opposed to 10 years ago, a much more robust kind of New York State farm economy. And you can get the quantity and the quality you need. They deliver regularly to New York. There's much less logistical barriers to that.
So I want to touch a little bit on some of the on one of the things that you just brought up as far as being encouraged or cajoled or to work with particular purveyors. What can you expand on that a little bit? I mean, does that mean you would get a list of people that you could buy from, or you had like a credit that you could use up? And
it was traditionally a kind of line of credit, almost like a giant debit card, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And the funding agency would do a good process of choosing a large purveyor, and then limit the items with a great emphasis on nutrition. You could only order X items. It was a rather large list. It could be hundreds of items. And because sometimes these were significant grants, because they were shared, we weren't the only ones receiving HPNAP monies. There could have been like $3 million worth of HPNAP money shared through 30 different agencies, and all those agencies had to buy through one purveyor. So you got a very good price.
Okay.
So that was which is for all of us, a good price is a good thing.
Yeah, of course.
So that I think historically is why it was, and it was easier. It's emergency food providers historically don't have huge levels of staffing, or frequently staffed by volunteers. So stuff that makes it logistically easier is always beneficial to them.
What is a HPNAP?
HPNAP. I'm sorry. It's Hunger Nutrition. And prevention program. It's state monies. Total of New York State last year awarded just around $30 million for foods that are going to communities that have significant areas of hunger in the state. It's been a very effective program. Almost all the money goes directly to food, very little to overhead.
And how does one determine that a neighborhood or an area is or isn't hungry?
It's done historically by U.S. Census poverty stats. It's done by the New York State Department of Health. It's done by the reporting of the nonprofit food providers who are there. We have to report regularly on how many folks we're serving, what the levels of need are, and then it's calculated for that. Because right now in New York City, 1 in 5 folks are using emergency food, and 1 in 4 children are going to a food pantry or a soup kitchen. So even in New York City, that's about 1.6 million folks.
Wow.
That's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people. And have you guys seen a growth in the need for your services kind of post-2008?
Yes. I mean, when everything happened in 2008, we had like a 32% increase. And we've been running on average now, subsequently, at 7 to 10% increase each year.
And is that increase in the need for your service? I mean, is the funding for that being met, or I mean, is
no.
it that you have an increase in need for service and a decrease in funding, and you're kind of stuck in the middle trying to balance?
It's been very in the world of food historically. The level of funding's been low. And like I mentioned, that $30 million, that has not grown for 5 years, even though both the need has grown and also, obviously, the cost of food has grown, as we've seen. And then the rest, even with my agency, we have to raise about 90% of our money privately. It's not government funding.
90%, you said.
90%, yeah, 90. 90% of the, we run approximately about just slightly under a $3 million a year budget, and 90% of that has to be raised privately between individuals and foundations.
And the organization has been around for how long?
We've it'll be 30 years this year, St. John's Bread and Life. It started like a lot of emergency food providers in 1982, which was a direct result of the Reagan cuts in the emergency food system. An interesting anecdote that in the late 70s, 79 and 80 in New York City, there were between 12 and 16 emergency food providers. By 1984, there were 1,600.
Wow.
So a huge direct result of the cuts in food stamps during the Reagan administration and that whole safety net.
So, I mean, I think that is something that's a little hard for people to wrap their heads around, this idea that people in America essentially can be hungry or can be faced yes. with like having to make choices between purchasing food and, you know, paying for their electric bill or clothing or, you know, kind of the myriad of costs that go with, you know, supporting yourself. And where is the balance between services that are provided by the government and services that are picked up by nonprofits like yourself? I mean, are you guys essentially the safety net for the safety net?
The major safety net for hunger in this country is the food stamp program, now known as the SNAP program. That is the major program. So, but then after that, it is us, because food stamps doesn't make it. I don't know if you remember, about a year ago, the food bank did a food stamp challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And if you receive food stamps as a single individual, you have to live on $4.50 a day. Now, try to do that. You can't buy a beer, Roberta's, for that, I don't think.
I don't think so.
But that's the average. If you were living on food stamps as a single adult, it was your food stamps equals $4.50 a day. And it grows for a family. It's about $12 a day for a family, which is very, very difficult to do, a family of four.
Sure. So
that safety net is not, it's got a lot of holes in it. And then you have the emergency food providers, which traditionally, we're one of the larger ones. Most of them still traditionally are small churches and synagogues and mosques. Just distribute food. So it's a significant problem in our country. It's running around 46 million Americans suffer from hunger. Interesting statistic that just came out that there's been a 25% increase in the number of folks with four-year college degrees who are availing themselves of food pantries and soup kitchens.
Wow.
And that should be those should be the folks who are getting a job. It's not a big problem.
Right.
So
are there any, requirements for use of your services? I mean, I think one of the other weird things that kind of happens around, you know, in particular in New York with the, you know, SNAP recipients needing to be fingerprinted, you know, there's this whole idea or this kind of talk around people, you know, taking advantage of or misusing the services as though there's some kind of covert activity where people are trying to, you know, take advantage of the system. Can you just respond a little bit to that mentality,
sure.
maybe where that's coming from and where that fits within the reality of what you see kind of day to day?
First of all, it doesn't fit into the reality. I mean, there was an interesting study that just came out 2 days ago by the Pew Institute that read a comprehensive study that showed the wealthier you are, the more likely you are to cheat on things.
I heard that, yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing, and you mentioned the image, the idea that we finger New York City finger images. We are the only us and Arizona, New York City and Arizona are the only places that finger image, and it's very interesting to criminalize a benefit because that's essentially what you're doing. I tell the story of my wife who's got a severe disability. She applied for disability. Disability called her. She did the entire interview on the phone, finished it up online. They said, we'll be in touch with you, ma'am, in about 60 days. In 59 days, money ended up in our bank account. We had no idea what it was. And then we got a letter the second day, the day following, saying, we've been approved for disability. These are your rates and things like that. And I thought, this is significantly more money than food stamps, done in a very dignified way. And it's interesting that we use a device for anti-fraud for folks who are poor, but we don't use the same device for folks who have means. And so I think there's historically in our country, there's been that kind of what Charles Dickens said, the bitter bread of charity, that you better be grateful for what we're giving you. There's also a notion, too, that the more hurdles you place, administrative hurdles you place on a benefit, the less folks will use it.
Well, I think that's one of the things that's always striking to me is somehow there's this seems to be this working assumption that if you're low income, you have lots of time to and also just like a lot of know-how and mobility to get from mm-hmm. place to place and to understand kind of a series of complex forms or, you know, bureaucracy essentially to muddle through to get your $4.50 a day worth of you know allotted food stamps or whatever mm-hmm. the service may be. Well, definitely some troubling stuff that we're going to tuck into a little bit more, but we're going to take a real quick break. Mm-hmm.
The following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
All right, we are back. You're tuned into the Farm Report. I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks, and we are on the line with Anthony Butler, Executive Director of St. John's Bread and Life. So before the break, we were talking about some of the, you know, state or I guess city-imposed barriers to access to, you know, food stamps in particular. But at Bread and Life, if someone needs to make use of your services, can you tell us how that works?
For our services, there the services we deliver, there are no barriers. If they want to come for hot food in our soup kitchen, our mobile soup kitchen, they simply show up. For our food pantry program, what we do is we register them. We ask for sort of believable proof of address, and we ask for proof of family size. Because our food pantry, one of the kind of unique things we do is we use a point system, and people actually order the food pantry off a touchscreen. We do that for two reasons. One, to continue to acclimate people to technology, because it's a skill we obviously need to navigate this world. And secondly, it allows us to drive certain foods to folks with certain needs. Give you an example. If folks choose our food pantry and they have hypertension, they can see our stuff with low sodium. If they have an obesity issue or something like that, they can see the low-fat things. We also, if you will, price, because people receive a certain amount of points and every item's worth a point, we price more nutritious food cheaper to encourage people to use that.
Excellent. And as far as food coming, kind of going back to food coming into the program,
oh, yes.
are there particular things that you tend to get from more of a regional source? I mean, do you have like a relationship with New York State farmers for, you know, apples or other kind of staple New York crops? Or how does some of that work when you're looking to increase kind of purchasing in that direction?
We do have direct relationships with New York State farmers. Some farmers in the Black Dirt region, the Gavlaki Farms, work with Windflower Farms up in Hoosick Falls. We're working with some folks in Miller's Crossing. So definitely, and what we're able to do is particularly, and we're also starting a new initiative to work with the Kingston co-packers to receive New York State farm food that's been flash frozen, which allows us to store it a little longer. And the farmers are very good at giving us a good price, contacting us if there's an overage and they have extra product that they can't use or can't sell. And what we do is we adjust our menus to that. In addition to that, one of the things we do, because part of the issue of eating nutritious food is that folks don't know how to use it. So we have regular cooking classes with chefs from the community. We give folks recipes. We sort of advertise what the new produce is and how to use it, and particularly teach people to cook these things so their kids will eat them, because that's one of the huge barriers. If you're a parent, you know that. To get your kids to eat vegetables is a tough thing.
Yeah, one of the other things I feel like you hear about often is kind of getting food to you that's in a form that makes it easier for you to use, so that somehow there's like this mid-level need in New York State in particular for services that will do things like the flash freezing or kind of, you know, peeling the onions or breaking down the potatoes. I mean, is there a particular, like if you had a magic wand, is there one food item or one thing that you're like, man, if we could only... Like, that would be awesome.
It's more of the ability to, those things that can be flash frozen that tend to spoil quickly. The root vegetables, the onions and potatoes, you can handle those because you don't have to move on them as quickly. The squashes in the fall. But we're very excited about some of our work around flash frozen produce and things like that. So it gives us some time to adjust menus, because the reality is, logistically, if we get something in and we don't have enough storage, we may have to switch the menu to use that more rapidly.
Can you give us some examples of where that's happened? I mean, have you ever had someone just kind of show up with a semi-load of lettuce? Or I think you shared a story for me when I visited about lobster. I would love to kind of share that with our listeners.
We did. I don't know if it's a good thing when I ask for donations to tell people we served lobster one day. But we received. But just to give you an example, we received a call from City Harvest. And City Harvest is one of the largest food rescue organizations in New York City. And they told us that they had 1,200 lobsters, because some fish wholesaler, the story was, he did not pay his taxes, and the marshals padlocked his building, and he didn't want the lobsters to die, so he donated them, and we had to shift the menu. We had to do a very quick cooking class, because it was, a foreign food. Folks weren't used to having lobsters.
Sure, you're not cooking a lot of lobster down there.
No, we don't. It may never happen again, but it was an interesting day, and luckily we had plenty of butter too, so it was good for the butter sauce. But we also received, last year, a farmer contacted us who he had planned to sell huge amounts of produce to Walmart. And something happened with the contract, and Walmart didn't need all of that. So he had grown it. They had paid him. He didn't want to destroy it. So he was delivering tractor-trailer loads of fall vegetables, mostly squashes and stuff. So we worked both to change our menus to use those, to address them in the food pantry and do cooking demonstrations so people would take them. And we also partner with other emergency food providers in the city. So if we get too many things, we will redistribute it to them so that food doesn't waste or is not wasted.
And is that pretty true? I mean, just generally that, you know, that food organizations are more collaborative than competitive. I mean, I'm sure there's probably a difference on the service end versus the fundraising end, but
exactly. Yes, very much so. I mean, we partner because we're all serving the same folks or same type of folks. And if we have resources, I mean, it would be a shame to, or a scandal to waste the resources. So yes, from the service end, very much so. And we're developing new partnerships with some of the smaller emergency food providers in Brooklyn who can't provide the kind of extra services, the human services we do, so that they can refer people to us. We're placing workers at their sites. So we can better partner, because our whole goal is both to prevent the worsening of poverty and to move people out of poverty.
So I'm curious, I mean, what's, you know, there's kind of this drive around Thanksgiving and Christmas every year where people are like, oh, I'm going to go volunteer at the soup kitchen and kind of do my part to alleviate hunger. And I don't want to disparage that inclination, but I also realize and recognize that people are hungry and that you have a need for, both donations of time and money year round. So maybe you could kind of share some of the different ways that people can get involved, and if there are particular times of the year or types of services that you're particularly in need of, it would be great to know that.
I do appreciate the opportunity. You're very right. I tell people that there's folks hungry January 1st, too. And we are in need of regular volunteers. Right now we are doing our tax program, so we're in need of evening and weekend volunteers. We are also obviously in need of donations. We are in need of people who have professional skills who want. We have the capacity that if you have, say, legal services or some type of professional skill, we can set you up with a desk and you can donate those. And all the information can be found at www.breadandlife.org. That's BREADANDLIFE.org. Both how to help us financially, help us with volunteer opportunities, and to find out more about us.
Awesome. And if I'm a farmer, do I get in contact with you if I have,
yes,
you know?
My contact information is on the website. Yes, definitely. We want to increase the farm participation. We also, one of the things we're working with farmers, too, is that we will kind of promote them, that it'll be, you know, Smith's Farm Day in the soup kitchen or something like that. Because I find the farm community and the food community very much gets this, too. They recognize the importance of feeding and the importance of preventing and lessening hunger. So it's a very exciting thing.
And I would just, you know, this is maybe a little bit out of purview, but, you know, there has been, you know, there is a lot of talk around neighborhoods that have high rates of hunger and in areas where there's essentially have become food deserts. And I'm curious, you know, aside from the services that you're providing, what do you think are maybe some of the solutions for getting rid of these food deserts and areas that we should be kind of thinking about or putting our like political muscle behind, if anything comes to mind?
I think some of the political muscle to support the Farm Bill that's in front of Congress right now, because that directly ties to food stamps. Just to give the listeners an idea, last year New York City lost $750 million of eligible food stamps. That's $750 million that would have come in to New York State bodegas, supermarkets, farmers, and the like. The encouragement of farmers markets is another one. The ability that all farmers markets can take the EBT, which are the food stamp cards, the food stamp swipe cards. And I think, and also in New York City, there's Speaker Quinn's doing some significant initiatives around making Hunts Point and our kind of produce distribution system much more friendly to New York State farmers, which will allow more stuff to come in.
Awesome. And then I was just wondering, I was sad to miss the No Food, No Farms rally this year for the first time, but I know you were up there as a speaker,
yes.
So maybe could you share a couple of highlights from the day for us?
I was at the No Farms, No Food rally, which is there to support New York State farmers and land conservation. It's a very exciting day. Robert Morgenthau was there. One of the exciting things was meeting Lieutenant Governor Duffy, former mayor of Rochester, and folks, Rochester has the honor of winning the nation's best farmers market.
Oh, wow.
And he was sharing with me, it's a huge farmer's market, and it's become so successful that it has raised the land values around the farmer's market in Rochester. They're building condominiums and nice homes. So it's had not just the effect of bringing good food in, but also bringing kind of economic development. And it was very interesting to talk with the farmers and meet the farmers and understand that this is an issue that's only going to be solved. This hunger issue is only going to be solved by all of us coming together and working on it. It's not simply a poverty issue. It's not simply feeling sorry for ourselves. It's not simply feeling sorry for the folks we serve. But rather what I learned up at the No Farms, No Food rally is that by all of us coming together, bringing both the food resources and the monetary resources to bear, we can significantly impact hunger in New York State.
Awesome. Great. Well, Anthony, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy travel schedule.
Oh, thank you.
to come on and share a little bit about the work at St. John's Bread and Life. Definitely check out the website if you're interested in getting involved. I know I will be stopping by as you guys are right around the corner from me. And
right.
Tune in next week at 1 o'clock for another episode of the Farm Report.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.